The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 26/October 3, 2022. It does not feature the usual red border on the front cover. It does, however, have a narrow marginal white inner border, but the outer edge is instead today gray. And Time, in large block letters in pale white, is superimposed upon pale shades of blue, from almost a green sea blue to a sky blue to, at the bottom of the page, an azure blue. What is printed on the cover, in addition to Time, is the Queen, Elizabeth II, 1926 to 2022. It is a portrait of the Queen by Cecil Beaton. It is undated, but she appears younger here than in her elder years of late. She is wearing the robe of the Garter, unembellished, no headpiece, no headgear, no crown, just her own dark brown chestnut hair. She's looking askance at the lens with light-colored eyes, blue, I believe. She is wearing the quintessential pearl earrings with a tiny diamond atop. The robe's collar is upturned in the back and then folds down in front. It is fastened by 2-4 bright gold-colored buttons. I do not know if they're brass or gold, with a closure at the top that involves 2 more larger buttons and a gold-colored chain, probably just a couple of inches in length. She is slightly smiling. For the Record is first. And let's see, we have here 7 items. "I'm just not going to leave," says Donald Trump to an aide after losing the 2020 election, according to a book excerpt released September 12 by New York Times journalist Maggie Haberman. 18%, the out-of-stock rate for powdered baby formula as of September 11, according to market research from IRI, compared with 10%. Before the nationwide recall. "When I was a little girl, all I wanted to see was me in the media, someone fat like me, black like me, beautiful like me," said Lizzo after winning an Emmy Award September 12 for Outstanding Competition Program for Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls. Girls is spelled G-R-R-L-S. "I want to thank God because a village boy has become the president of Kenya," said William Ruto September 13 after being sworn into office following a contested election in August. 200, the number of miles traveled by a Chinese pine nut picker in a hydrogen balloon after it came untethered September 4. Pumpkin spice, in parentheses N, period, one of the 370 words and phrases added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary in September 2022. I am always ready to go to China. Spoken by Pope Francis, September 13, after arriving in Kazakhstan for a three-day visit that was expected to overlap with a trip by Chinese President Xi Jinping. On the verso of For the Record, I'm going to read an ad today, not usually included in our repertoire. It's very simple. It's toys. It's Lego toys. It says Rebuild the World with the Lego logo, and it has a stage, and it has a heart on top, attached to nothing, apparently. But on the stage, we have someone who looks eerily like a Mozart walking across, and meeting him is a punk rocker with purple spiky hair walking across. The brief, The Royals. There's a photo here at the bottom of the page, not very large, but in color. It's captioned, a memorial outside Balmoral Castle, September 9. There's a balloon in gold that says Queen Elizabeth, and it's sort of shaped like a crown with a heart on top. We see the back of a little person. I think it's a little fellow with blonde hair cut above the collar. A white collar, we're seeing the back now, so I don't know what the face looks like. A blue shirt or blue sweatshirt or sweater pulled over that white collar. Dark colored, either dark gray or black Bermuda shorts, and almost touching the shorts, knee-high socks and black shoes, like little black tennis shoes. The hands are behind the person, clasped at his back. And he's looking at, I'm saying he, I don't know, the little person is looking at bunches of flowers stacked so neatly with their stems at the ground and their blooms at the top, and there are colors of pink and white and pale yellow and bright yellow and orange and red. And here's the text then. Braving wind and rain, a silent line of mourners snake to the wrought iron gate of Edinburgh's Holyrood Palace, September 9, patiently waiting their turn to read the official notice announcing Queen Elizabeth II's death. To one side, bouquets piled against the granite wall of an improvised memorial garden, most with heartfelt messages attached to the only monarch most Brits have ever known. Across the UK, the passing of the Queen left a chasm. At Balmoral Castle, where she died September 8, floral tributes continue to amass. At London's St. Paul's Cathedral, a September 9 service of prayer and reflection was attended by 2,000 members of the public, as well as London Mayor Sadiq Khan and the UK's new Prime Minister, Liz Truss. The unhappy news, arriving at 6:30 p.m., had hit Britons hard. Most were home or at pubs, enjoying an after-work libation. Within hours, a crowd of thousands gathered outside Buckingham Palace in London in solemn remembrance, breaking into muffled cheers of God Save the King when Charles III arrived the next day to a home he entered as sovereign for the very first time. Queen Elizabeth encompasses so much of what is Britain, Eleanor Allingham from Edinburgh told Time outside the palace. She was a huge role model for everyone, every woman, every British person. The Queen was also the constitutional head of state for 14 other nations, which have been paying their own tributes, even as the debate reignites about the legacy of the British Empire, which was already dwindling at the time of her coronation in 1953. In its stead, a Commonwealth of independent former colonies has maintained close bonds with their erstwhile empress. In Nassau, Bahama, people stayed glued to television sets for news on arcane royal funeral rites. Yet amid the outpouring of grief, questions will rumble louder about why King Charles III should now be their head of state from a distance of thousands of miles. Last year, Barbados decided to become a republic, although it will remain part of the Commonwealth. Other nations will be wrestling with similar sentiments. for now, with a 10-day official mourning period following the Queen's death, a feeling of pause has enveloped the nation. I feel numb, said Wendy Green, 45, who came to pay her respects at the Queen's official residence in the Scottish capital, over which the national flag flew at half-staff. We will never have another quite like her. And that was written by Charlie Campbell of, or I should say, at Edinburgh. The new king will be all right. As all eyes turned to King Charles III, journalist and famed royal watcher Tina Brown offers some insights on what kind of monarch the longtime heir apparent is likely to be. Brown's latest book, The Palace Papers, pulls back the curtains on some of the inner workings of the royal family. This article is in a question and answer format. The first question, how would you rate King Charles III's response to his ascension to the throne and his mother's death? Answer, his royal training has completely kicked in. Both his naval training as an officer and his years and decades of attending big royal ceremonial occasions has just schooled him in this impeccable conduct. Each one of his different speeches has been both potent and also human. Charles has been acclaimed with enormous love and affection by the British nation in the last few days. In a sense, this is the first time that Charles has really been able to experience that. A question, is King Charles III likely to run into trouble given his advocacy on the climate and his history of trying to intervene in policy? Answer, Charles knows that the days of speaking out vocally on those things are done. He actually said in an interview, I'm not that stupid, and I don't think he will. He doesn't need to. The truth is, we know what he thinks about climate change. The other thing that will be very helpful for Charles when he becomes king, at a point when we have a very inexperienced and divisive Prime Minister, Liz Truss, who hasn't done this job before and who has not been elected by the whole country. So he actually will appear to be the more statesman-like figure. Question, how will the king respond to the very public controversy over Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, distancing themselves from the royal family? Answer, Charles is going to be reaching out to Harry a lot, and I think he wants very much to heal that rift. Whether or not the rift can be healed will be more down to whether or not the Duchess feels that she would ever want to return to the family fold. Question, there are already rumblings that some nations will cut ties with the monarchy. What will that mean for the crown? Answer, Charles fully expects that to happen. He's actually quite accepting of it. He knows that by the time we get to new heir to the throne, Prince William, the sovereign realms will be gone. One of Charles's thorniest challenges is to address the lasting damage of colonialism, for which there is rising vocal demand. Question, is there a chance the British monarchy could be abolished in the foreseeable future? Answer, no, not in the foreseeable future. It's been 1,200 years and going strong. The answer is in the 5-mile lines to see the Queen lying in state. The monarchy stands above partisan politics. It is a symbol of unity that unites the country at moments of grief and moments of joy. That article by Olivia B. Waxman. A photograph here of King Charles III at Buckingham Palace in London, September 9, the day after the Queen's death. He's surrounded by a crowd, and the crowd is blurred in the camera lens, but it's several people deep on all sides. He's wearing a dark suit, I believe it is black, a white shirt, and what looks like either a very dark gray or black tie. His gray hair, to white almost, is combed back as usual. He has a frown, but I don't know if that's because of his mood, his state of mind, or the sun being in his eyes, because it definitely looks like there's a sunny reflection against his face. He's neither smiling nor not smiling. To his right is a very, very large person, a man. We see only in this photo a portion of his face and his shoulders. He has a dark suit and a white shirt and a tie on, and I'm guessing it's probably one of the royal bodyguards. Renewed calls to return Crown Jewel. A photo here of a crown. This is not a tiara or a diadem. It is a royal crown with purple velvet in the hat place. Otherwise, it's a frame of metal with gobs and gobs and gobs of jewels. There's a fleur-de-lis pattern, kind of an impressionistic rose design, but it may actually be symbolizing something else. And then on the top, a globe-looking affair at the spokes of the filigree support. And on top of that, another square-ish piece of jewelry art with what looks like another huge hunk of jewelry placed in it. Return calls to return Crown Jewel. Shortly after Queen Elizabeth died, September 8, Kohinoor, that's K-O-H-I-N-O-O-R, began trending on Indian Twitter. It is a reference to a 105.6-carat diamond set in a 1937 crown worn by the Queen's mother. The stone, one of the world's largest cut diamonds, is to believe to have been mined between the 12th and 14th centuries. It was in Mughal, Persian, and Afghan hands before coming into the possession of the last ruler of the Sikh Empire, Maharaja Duleep Singh. The British took it from him in 1849, and it has been part of the crown jewels ever since. India has long demanded the famous stone's return, as have the governments of Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. British Indian author Saurav Dutt believes the chances of the UK relinquishing the jewel are slim because the British are married to this romantic version of empire, symbolized by the Kohinoor. Nevertheless, Dutt believes King Charles III must acknowledge the stone's black history as a step toward its repatriation by a future generation. Many Indians may not have that patience. One Twitter user summed up the mood when she asked, "How can we get our Kohinoor back?" And that column was written by Chad de Guzman. Here is the brief news from News Ticker. Three short items: Armenia and Azerbaijan clash at border. Around 100 soldiers were killed in fighting on the disputed border between Armenia and Azerbaijan, September 13. Armenia's defense minister charged Azerbaijani artillery barrages and drone attacks started the hostilities between countries that have fought two wars in the past 3 decades. National abortion ban proposed. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina proposed a bill September 13 that would create a federal ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The measure is unlikely to pass in the Democratic-controlled Senate, but it highlights the importance of November midterm elections. Chileans reject new constitution. Chile's voters overwhelmingly rejected a new progressive constitution that would have enshrined rights to free speech, abortion, clean air and water, and a publicly funded national health service. Critics said the proposal, which included 388 articles and was rejected September 4 by 62% of voters, went too far and would be difficult to enforce. Good question. What does the January 6th committee have planned for its final act? a photo here at the bottom of the page, not too large, but in color, of three individuals seated behind an official-looking podium. Representatives Benny Thompson, Democrat, Liz Cheney, Republican, and Adam Kinzinger, Republican, of the January 6 committee. When the January 6 committee wrapped its eighth public hearing of the year in July, the members signaled they would return after the congressional recess for a final slate of hearings and then release its report. Our committee will spend August pursuing emerging information on multiple fronts. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, and vice chair of the panel said, adding at the end of the session, "See you in September." Since returning to Washington, the committee investigating the deadly January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol has been spending much of the month working out its next moves. After breakthrough summer hearings that painted a devastating picture of former President Donald Trump's efforts to hold on to power, the big logistical question committee members must settle is how many more hearings they should hold. "I don't think we know for sure yet," Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, tells Time. "My guess would be that it's in the neighborhood of two or three. While the next hearing will likely be later this month, any remaining ones will bleed into October." Committee members say the final hearings will include significant revelations. With the midterm elections looming, the panel's on the clock to complete its investigation and publish its report, which will lay out its findings in narrative detail. If Republicans win back control of the House, they're expected to shut down the panel early next year. The House resolution establishing the committee says it is to be terminated 30 days after issuing the report. Obviously, if the Republicans win the midterms, the committee's going to be folded up, Andrew McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor, tells Time. He adds, "If this had been a normal investigation, rather than one that had been on a compressed time frame, then I think they would have done a lot of things differently." Other issues still being worked out include whether there will be testimony from high-profile political figures whose actions in the aftermath of the election have raised questions, such as Jenny Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. The members argue they've already accomplished a considerable feat with their earlier hearings, which revived a national discussion of the Capitol riot. An NBC survey in August found threats to democracy had overtaken inflation and the economy as the top concern of respondents. "I think our major breakthrough has been that the country now understands with striking detail how these extraordinary events took place," Raskin says. And that article was by Eric Cortalesa. Milestones died Ken Starr, that's S-T-A-R-R, defensive prosecutor. In the well of the Senate on January 27, 2020, Ken Starr stood a little jittery but plenty excited. It was a familiar tableau for a man whose work and accompanying best-selling government report in the 1990s brought about only the second impeachment of a U.S. president. Roughly two decades later, he was arguing, without an ounce of irony, that the country was living in an age of impeachment, as senators considered its third. "Like war, impeachment is hell," Starr said, defending Donald Trump from his first impeachment trial, which ended in acquittal. Starr died September 13 at age 76, a result of complications from surgery. Starr would come to say he regretted how his pursuit of Bill and Hillary Clinton's culpability in a bum real estate deal escalated. But his crusade defined the culture wars of the late 1990s, and perhaps in ways Americans still do not grasp, shaped the country's politics for decades. Legacy tends to outweigh regrets. That was by Philip Elliott. Died Moon Landreau, Landrieu, Tribune of a New South by Walter Isaacson, who's a professor of history at Tulane University and a former editor of Time. On his first week as a young Louisiana legislator, two powerful old politicians cornered Moon Landrieu in an elevator, poked their fingers in his chest, and threatened that if he voted against their racial segregation bills, they would destroy him. He did, and they did not. At a time when George Wallace and others were hijacking Southern populism and turning it racist, Landrieu forged coalitions that united blacks and whites. Chomping on an unlit cigar while arm-twisting a local assessor at a neighborhood bar, Landrieu, who died of heart failure September 5 at age 92, could seem like an old-fashioned urban ethnic politician, which he was. But during his career as a legislator, councilman, and mayor of New Orleans during the 1960s and 1970s, he led a historic transformation in the city's race relations and became one of the tribunes of what became known for a glorious but brief period as the New South. With a feel for how to balance progress and preservation, he helped build the city's downtown Superdome and protect the French Quarter and other historic neighborhoods, displaying an urban sensibility that he took to Washington when he became President Jimmy Carter's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. His ideals were later advanced by his daughter Mary, a three-term U.S. senator, and his son Mitch, a two-term New Orleans mayor and currently President Biden's infrastructure coordinator, and perhaps will be again by some of his 37 grandchildren. Died Jean-Luc Godard, New Wave, Trailblazer. With the death of French-Swiss director Jean-Luc Godard on September 13 at age 91, the world lost an artist who moved the boundaries of what a camera could do and whose prickly wit and defiant radical politics electrified moviegoers in the 1960s and beyond. Godard's cannon shot debut, Breathless, 1959, helped usher in the French New Wave, and his 1960s output includes some of the decade's greatest films, Contempt, 1963, and Pierrot Le Fou, 1965, among them, even if the movies he made in later decades never topped that initial eight-year rush, it is more than enough to secure his legacy. He was so modern in 1959 that he will be modern forever, youth found not in a jar but in a film can. It's we who grow old around him. By Stephanie Zakarik, and features a small black-and-white photo of Godard leaning on a table with cameras behind him. He has a receding hairline, but lots of dark hair flowing behind it. He's wearing dark glasses and a dark suit. A black page here with small white lettering at the top, Remembrance. Large lettering in capitals in gold, Queen Elizabeth, more white, 1926 to 2022, more gold, by Steve Doherty and Larry Sutton, more white. Across a record-setting reign, Britain's monarch strove to embody the steadfast spirit she encouraged in her subjects. Another full-page photo here by Cecil Beaton at Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Captioned Queen Elizabeth II, photographed in 1968 in England. Based upon her appearance here, I would say that that cover photo reflects that date or period in time. Here she's dressed in formal attire, a blue formal dress with a lot of sequins and jewels in the bodice. Heavy duty. A necklace around her neck with pearls and diamonds, heavy-duty bracelet, three rows of large diamonds, her typical watch on her left wrist, and her engagement and wedding rings on her left hand. She's wearing a badge of possibly the garter, but I'm not positive about that. It's pinned to a dark navy blue sash. At her shoulder, then, is pinned a very large, heavy-duty bow pin in a silver-colored metal with glistening jewels. Earrings, it looks like pearl and diamond, but not the ones she usually wore. Fancier ones here. And a tiara with overlapping circles of diamonds with pearls dropping from the top of each of the circles. Again, she's looking askance from the camera, smiling slightly. The background is a pale platinum gray. To the text. Queen Elizabeth II was the world's longest-serving head of state when she died at 96, September 8. She had led her subjects for more than 7 decades, an extraordinary reign that began in 1952 and spanned 15 British prime ministers and 14 U.S. presidents. She inherited the throne of a country almost broken by the legacy of war and remained upon it through a time of epochal change for both the UK and the world. When Elizabeth took the throne, the UK was the seat of an empire that straddled the globe. Today, Britain's a smaller player on the world stage, but she remained the sovereign leader of 15 nations, including Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, and head of a commonwealth of more than 50 nations. She traveled the globe as an ambassador for British achievements, acts of charity, and values. She was also devoted to upholding the special relationship between the UK and the US, engaging with every president from Harry Truman to Joe Biden over a period of more than 70 years. And even as the world changed in profound ways, many saw her as a steadfast rock of patriotic duty. As her grandson, Prince William, wrote in the preface to a 2015 biography, "I think I speak for my generation when I say that the example and continuity provided by the Queen is not only very rare among leaders, but a great source of pride and reassurance. I am privileged to have the Queen as a model for a life of service to the public." Another photo here, full page, black and white. Everyone is dressed in fancy court ritualistic clothing here. I shan't describe every detail. I'll read the caption. Coronation Day. Queen Elizabeth II arrives at Westminster Abbey for her coronation, June 2, 1953, joined by her maids of honor and the Duke of Edinburgh. Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor was born by cesarean section at 2:40 a.m., April 21, 1926. She was an heir to the throne, but third in the line of succession. Her father, Prince Albert, Bertie, to friends and family, was the second son of the reigning monarch, King George V. His older brother David, known by his royal appellation Edward of Wales, was first in line to the throne, but also single, childless, and already rumored to have little interest in inheriting his father's crown. The early life of Princess Elizabeth was chronicled with zeal, both by the British press and in the former colonies. The water was from the River Jordan, Time reported of the elaborate christening pageantry staged in the private chapel at Buckingham Palace. Sir Winston Churchill first met Elizabeth at Balmoral Castle in 1928 when she was 2, and proclaimed that he saw in her an air of authority and reflectiveness, astonishing in an infant. No one in the realm was more enamored with the young Elizabeth than its monarch, who gave her the place of honor on his lap when they rode through the streets of London in his royal stretch Daimler. "No one else except the Queen rides out so often with the King," Time reported. Left out of the spotlight, but not ungladly, was Lilibet's father, the self-deprecating Bertie, who once told reporters, "My chief claim to fame seems to be that I am the father of Princess Elizabeth." Her reign as only child ended at age 4 in 1930 with the birth of her sister Margaret Rose at Glamis Castle in Scotland. Their mother's ancestral home, the girls romped together on the palace grounds and royal country estates, played with their terrier puppies and corgis, Elizabeth's lifelong favorite. They also stabled, cared for, and learned to train a royal succession of pet ponies, and shared the same nannies and governesses. In January 1936, upon the death of Lilibet's grandfather, George V, her uncle David became King Edward VIII. Almost immediately, his eldest niece and all the royal family became prime players in a 20th century succession drama. Edward's tumultuous 10-month reign as king ended December 10, 1936, when he scandalized the world by abdicating the throne to Mary, the twice-divorced American socialite Wallace Warfield Simpson. "I always told these idiots not to put me in a golden frame," he said. Young Lilibet was only 10 when she learned she would become queen after her father's death. There's a quote here in the margin that I shall read. It is attributed to Princess Elizabeth at age 3, 1927-1930, ascribed to Time, and the quote reads, "Famed as Baby Betty before she could talk, she now asserts, 'I am Lilibet the Princess.'" Actually, she skipped the R. "I am Lilibet the Princess." Back to the text. Elizabeth was barely a teenager when on September 3, 1939, Britain declared war on Nazi Germany. The war's threat had already thundered throughout Europe, and soon the kingdom Elizabeth would one day rule, along with much of the rest of the world, was engulfed in war. Less than a year later, Hitler entered Paris and promised to make Britain his next conquest. Soon the Blitz, day and night Luftwaffe bombing raids that rained fire and terror over cities throughout England was at full roar. And so the princess spent her teen years knitting socks for British soldiers, collecting tin foil, and rolling bandages for the war effort. She would send portions of her 5-shilling weekly allowance to emergency child welfare funds, wear second-hand clothes, adhere to the war rations diet dictated for all Britons, and live frugally despite being a teenage princess and heir to the British throne. Even as bombs fell on Buckingham Palace, the royal couple refused entreaties to abandon London and evacuate Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret to Canada. "The children won't go without me," said the Queen. "I won't leave without the King, and the King will never leave." The King's decision to remain in England for the duration of the war, enduring its deprivations along with his subjects, endeared him to the beleaguered nation. But it also made the likelihood that Elizabeth might suddenly be called to the throne in the event of her father's death seem palpable. The future monarch began her public life with her first live BBC radio broadcast in October 1940. Displaying poise and pluck, she addressed the tens of thousands of children who were evacuated from their homes and separated from their families at the height of the Blitz. "My sister Margaret Rose and I feel so much for you, as we know from experience what it means to be away from those we love most of all," she said in a clear voice that offered a hint of the calm and compassion that many would come to admire. When in 1944 she reached military age at 18, Elizabeth joined the Auxiliary Territorial Service, one of the wartime women's units. She spent 3 weeks at the Mechanical Transport Training Center, where she trained as a mechanic and truck driver. The labor left her covered in grease and grime and not a little well-earned pride. And she never partied so hard as she did a fortnight after her 19th birthday, when May 8, 1945, Victory in Europe Day, she joined the ecstatic and rowdy street celebrations that swept London following Germany's surrender. After standing in uniform on the balcony at Buckingham Palace to greet cheering crowds alongside the King, Queen, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, she, her sister, a group of friends, and a few guardians linked arms and ran among the crowds that surged through the city. For two nights in a row, she walked simply miles, she wrote in her journal. At 8, party's bed, 3 a.m., these were, she would say 40 years later, among the most memorable nights of my life. Years before, Elizabeth had visited a naval college at Dartmouth, where she'd been greeted by a towering 18-year-old cadet. Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark was born on the Greek island of Corfu, June 10, 1921. Nephew of King Constantine of Greece and distant relation to Britain's Queen Victoria. As his family drifted apart, he was sent at the age of 9 to England to live with his grandmother, the widow of the great British naval commander and German prince, Louis Alexander Mountbatten. He was schooled in England, Germany, and Scotland and became a fine young athlete, as Elizabeth would note to her governess, Crawfey, on that trip to Dartmouth. How good he is, Crawfey. How high can he jump? Elizabeth corresponded with Philip throughout the war, and after its end, the prince was placed on shore duty at a naval base on England's south coast. He often made the 100-mile trek to London in his small black MG, frequently stopping at Buckingham Palace. As the friendship grew into a romance, Elizabeth was delighted. Her father, George, not so much at first. His loud, boisterous laugh and his blunt, seagoing manners irritated the gentle king, Time reported in 1957. Despite that chill, Elizabeth and Philip decided to marry after a short stay with her family at Balmoral Castle in the summer of 1946. The king's lack of enthusiasm for Elizabeth's beau, an attitude sparked in part by his concern over how the people of Britain would take to a foreign-born prince marrying the heiress to the throne, frustrated the princess. There was many a tense moment for George as Elizabeth moped about in tearful martyrdom, while her mother and grandmother, the doughty old Queen Mary, fought her battle for her. At last, George decided that the young couple, she was 20, he was 25, should wait 6 months to make sure of each other, noted Time. There were obstacles to overcome, but none insurmountable. Philip became a British citizen, and public opinion polls showed that a majority of the nation's populace favored his marrying the princess. The official announcement did not come until July 1947, followed by the couple's introduction at a Buckingham Palace garden party. The wedding took place that November. On the 20th, Philip had converted from Greek Orthodoxy to Anglicanism, and Elizabeth's father made the former member of the Greek and Danish royal families a British royal duke, the Duke of Edinburgh, to be called His Royal Highness, or simply Prince Philip. As Elizabeth made her way to Westminster Abbey in the royal coach on her wedding day, thousands cheered from the neighboring sidewalks of London. Celebrations erupted throughout the globe, from Paris to Panama, from Shanghai to Manhattan, where thousands got out of bed at 6 a.m. to listen to the ceremony broadcast on the radio. Dignitaries, 5 kings, 6 queens, Prime Minister Clement Attlee, Winston Churchill were in attendance. All of Britain celebrated, many seeing the wedding as a beacon of hope in the post-World War II recovery period. February 5, 1952, Princess Elizabeth went to bed in a tree hut nestled in Kenya's Aberdare National Park and awoke the next day as Queen of England. She was unaware of her new position, for news of the death of her father, King George VI, had not yet reached the outpost of the British Empire. That afternoon, at a lodge, Philip received a phone call informing him of George's death. The prince took his bride down to a nearby river's edge and relayed the news. Shaken, but in full command of herself, Elizabeth returned to the lodge and began making arrangements for the long trip home. Elizabeth arrived at London's airport the following morning. Churchill was there to greet her, along with a small group of privy councillors, advisors to the monarchy. That night she rested. The next day she signed the oath of accession before the Privy Council, and an hour later her accession was formally proclaimed. In the months that followed, there was no hurry to arrange her formal coronation. She was already technically the queen, so Elizabeth and the palace allowed the focus to stay on King George and his 16 enormously popular years on the throne, and let the nation's sadness ebb. The ceremony finally took place June 2, 1953. A day chosen in hopes of sunny spring weather, this being London, however, the nation settled for a traditional gray morning. At 11 a.m., a joyous fanfare of trumpets announced the arrival of Her Majesty. "Vivat Regina Elisabetta, vivat, vivat, vivat," shouted the Queen's Westminster scholars as she walked up the aisle, her long crimson train borne by 6 maids of honor. The Archbishop of Canterbury proceeded to ask Elizabeth if she would govern her people according to their laws and customs, execute law and justice in mercy, and maintain the laws of God. She knelt, kissed the Holy Bible before her, and swore to do so, so help me God. Finally, he held aloft the imperial state crown for all to see, then placed it on Elizabeth's head. Cheers of God Save the Queen filled the abbey as trumpets blared. Outside and across the British Empire, bells pealed and cannons roared. Stopping here for a couple of more photos. Princess Elizabeth amid a syringa bush on the grounds of Windsor Castle, July 8, 1941. She is a young woman here. She has almost long flowing hair. It's a bit curly, but it's brown, and she's smiling, and she's wearing a very light pink to white dress. One sees only the collar and the shoulders. She's wearing a tiny, dainty pearl necklace. She has her right hand on one of the branches of this bush, which bears white flowers, kind of like a little star flower, and she's smiling at the camera. And then another photo here in black and white. It is Princess Elizabeth at work, April 12, 1945. She's learning car maintenance as a second subaltern in the ATS, a branch of the British Army in which women served during World War II. She's on her hands and knees. Well, not her hands, because she's fixing a tire on this truck. But she's on her knees in her ATS uniform, looking very serious about this tire-changing bit. Back to the text. As well as the constitutional duties Elizabeth fulfilled as Britain's head of state and the head of the Church of England, she spent long sections of the following decades traveling the world as her nation's goodwill ambassador. The November after her coronation, she embarked on a 45,000-mile tour of the British Commonwealth, presiding over state balls, garden parties, luncheons, banquets, and other occasions. Among her stops, Libya, Australia, Fiji, New Zealand, Jamaica, Uganda, and the Pacific island of Tonga. She did not return to London till May 15, 1954, almost 6 months after she departed. I'm going to turn the page here and skip a lot of text. It took time for Elizabeth, a woman married 7 decades to the same man, to adjust to modern mores. Charles and Camilla got engaged around Christmas 2004, and before long, the Queen issued a statement saying, "The Duke of Edinburgh and I are very happy that the Prince of Wales and Mrs. Parker Bowles are to marry." She and Prince Philip did not attend their wedding at Windsor Guildhall, April 9, 2005, but they did attend a blessing of the couple at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle and held a reception for them at the castle. A more festive wedding, and one more in keeping with Elizabeth's sense of tradition, took place April 29, 2011, when Elizabeth's grandson William married Kate Middleton in a lavish ceremony at Westminster Abbey. And she remained her regal self at Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's more modern wedding at Windsor Castle in 2018. Which included a fiery sermon delivered by Bishop Michael Curry of Chicago, the first African-American head of the Episcopal Church in the U.S. I don't know where they came up with Chicago, but there it is. But in a televised interview with Oprah Winfrey in March 2021, Harry and Meghan alleged racism had tarnished their relationship with the Windsors. While the press hounded Meghan as they did Harry's late mother, "No one from my family ever said anything," Harry said. The family was a source of comfort. As the Queen neared the end of her life, she doted on her grandchildren and great-grandchildren in a small room with close members of the family. "Then she's just a normal grandmother. Very relaxed," Harry said, before he and Meghan stepped back as working royals in early 2020. "She obviously takes a huge interest in what we all do." Even after she entered her ninth decade, Elizabeth continued with her royal duties despite her age and a rapidly changing world. For nearly all her reign, the Queen would read a selection of the 200 to 300 letters she received daily, as well as review official papers and documents sent her way from government ministers and her representatives in foreign countries. Until she was forced to slow down by mobility issues and bouts of ill health, she would have 10 to 20 minute audiences with ambassadors, commissioners, and other officials, and there would be her weekly visit from the British Prime Minister. Despite growing Republican movements within the Commonwealth realms, the Queen herself remained a hugely popular figure in both the UK and beyond, and she remained a force for good, offering messages of inspiration and optimism in even the most trying times. In one of her last annual Christmas messages, she urged her subjects in Britain and across the Commonwealth to draw inspiration from ordinary people doing extraordinary things. To many, she embodied the steadfastness she urged in others. At Prince Philip's funeral, held shortly after he died, April 9, 2021, after 73 years of marriage, the monarch solemnly sat alone in a pew at Windsor Castle because of coronavirus restrictions. The image became instantly iconic and further burnished her legacy as a stoic leader through good times and bad. The Queen has been a constant figure in most of the British public's living memory. Difficulty moving prevented her from attending the majority of Buckingham Palace's Platinum Jubilee celebrations, as the nation in June 2022 marked her 70th year on the throne, a first for a British monarch. But community celebrations were widespread across the UK. Some 16,000 official street parties were organized, and almost 17 million, about one in four Brits, took part in events. The Queen did not lead an ordinary life, but she filled it with inspiring acts of duty, both public and private, whether carrying out the requirements of the state from the trappings of the throne, or giving quiet words of encouragement to a well-wisher in a crowd. "She has been a rock of stability in an era in which our country has changed so much," said Britain's former Prime Minister David Cameron, "and we could not be more proud of her. She has served this country with unerring grace, dignity, and decency." Again, this article, which was abbreviated, was written by Steve Doherty and Larry Sutton, with reporting by Eloise Berry, Kathy Erdick-Dowd, Madeline Roach, and Yasmin Sirhan. A couple of more photos here with captions. Queen Elizabeth is pictured with Nelson Mandela, no date given. Harry Truman, Gerald Ford, with whom she's dancing, Margaret Thatcher. And on the bottom row of this double row of pictures, Winston Churchill, Ronald Reagan, Kwame Nkrumah, and Liz Truss 2 days before the Queen's death. The one of her with Nkrumah also features a smiling, very short Princess Anne. It appears that they are standing outside one of the palaces. The Queen, of course, is dressed in a suit. This one appears to be polka-dotted. And from the cut, it looks like this was a photo from the 60s, perhaps, or late 50s. There she is, wearing that big bow pin again, her triple strand of pearls, pearl earrings, and her purse. And in the last photo, it is the Queen with Liz Truss 2 days before she died. She's so tiny and fragile looking. Standing in front of a beautiful mantelpiece with huge candelabra and a gold clock and some rose decorated vases or vases, probably. She's carrying her walking stick. She's extending her hand to congratulate Liz Truss, and she's smiling. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If we have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.